If you've been watching the PBS documentary, The Vietnam War, you've met Baldwin City resident John Musgrave. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, we're devoting the entire hour to tell the story of his Vietnam journey. Musgrave is featured in the new Ken Burns Lynn Novick documentary, The Vietnam War. If you missed my interview with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick last month, it's now archived at our website, kpr.ku.edu. While they were in Kansas City, I asked them about John Musgrave and the role he played in their documentary.
I've always said that if some evil genie went and took away all of our hundreds of interviews and left us with just one, I would pick John Musgrave and retitle the film The Education of John Musgrave. He's an incredibly brave and courageous human being, a Marine. When we focus on wars, we sometimes tend to forget that the conflicts are not just between tribes and armies and nations, but within people. And the battles that we do within ourselves are a hugely important part of and consequence of war. And John has been extraordinarily generous in sharing with us the whole arc of his experiences as he traveled through time and space dealing with Vietnam and its memories and its ghosts. And he's an incredibly honest person. He's an incredibly good man. And I've spent my entire life studying Americans and many, many amazing Americans. And I don't know anyone who's more amazing than John Musgrave.
It was our great good fortune. Sometimes we get lucky on a project like this. And in this project, we got lucky many times over. But our colleague Sarah Botstein is the producer of the series. Her ex-husband works with veterans and has been traveling the country doing a variety of things. And he met John Musgrave at an event that he did in 2010. And he told his wife Sarah, his then wife Sarah, you know, I've just met this veteran, you need to talk to him. And, you know, that was not something he did all the time, and he did meet a lot of veterans, so we took notice. And I spoke with John over the phone and had a great conversation with him and thought, you know, this guy's really interesting. I think that we should meet. So we had a meeting, and after that meeting, he agreed to be interviewed for the film. And he was willing to come to New York and do the interview there because, for a variety of reasons, that made sense for us. And I think that was in 2011, so it's quite a long time ago. And, I mean, he knows who we were. He's familiar with Ken's other films, and he knew what he was getting into, but I don't think we understood at the time how powerful his interview would be and how profound, how generous he was going to be, how important his story is to our overall narrative of the war. And I don't want to give away too much, but he's a tremendously powerful voice among many in this film, and we can't really say enough about how much we are grateful to him for telling us his story, for his service to our country, for his honesty about what the war was really like, and for letting us have a window into his journey. It's been a profound experience for everybody on this film. Ken and I we often say if something terrible happened and we lost all the material we'd filmed for this film and we had one thing left and it was John Musgrave's interview, it would be okay.
That's Lynn Novick and Ken Burns in Kansas City last month to promote their documentary, The Vietnam War. They were speaking of John Musgrave, raised in Independence, Missouri, now living in Baldwin City, Kansas. On today's KPR Presents, we're devoting the entire hour to John Musgrave's Vietnam journey, which he shared with us in the KPR studios.
I was a son of working class parents. My father had been a teenage pilot in World War II in the Army Air Force. He met my mother working in a defense plant where they were building bombers. So both of my parents had served their country in the Second World War. My generation was fortunate in that if we were looking for heroes, all we had to do was look across the dinner table. And we saw people who'd helped save the world. And I was inspired by those people. My male contacts, adults, were veterans, mostly from World War II, some from Korea, and some of my teachers had been served their country with the draft during the Cold War, but they'd all served. And the baby boomer generation, that's who we are, we're the welcome home honey kids, we grew up. We were the first generation to grow up with the draft as it was an institution that was a part of our life from the time we were old enough to understand the definitions of words like duty and obligation and inevitability. We knew as males we owed our country 2 years of service. And it didn't matter whether it was war or peace. We owed it to our country. We had real enemies, the Russians and the Red Chinese. We were terrified. We did fire drills. We did tornado drills. And we did nuclear attack drills. Duck and cover. Our grade school became the first community bomb shelter in our community. So we were thinking about the bomb and the communist all of our lives. And in high school, the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the world was literally on the brink of annihilation. And I remembered wondering, I think I was a sophomore in high school, might have been a freshman, but I remember wondering if I was going to live long enough to kiss a girl. I don't remember how old I was when I decided that I was going to be a Marine, but it was quite a while back, and I was looking forward to it. Military service to me was going to be a shortcut to manhood. I was tired of not counting, of being treated as if I had nothing positive to offer to my country or my community. My opinions weren't sought or listened to, and I knew that I had something to give. But at 17, your avenues are very limited. And the military, for me, was a way to give to my country, and it was something mature. It was something that, at that time, was respectable, and it was a ticket out of my neighborhood. I'd been wearing a uniform since I was 8 years old. I became a Cub Scout. And I went through Cub Scouts, and I went into Boy Scouts, and I went through Boy Scouts, and I was an Eagle Scout, proud of it, still am. And throughout scouting, you are being prepared for adulthood and service to your community and to your country. So these were steps on a journey. And it wasn't out of character. And it wasn't like I was stepping off a path that I'd been on since childhood. It was the next step to another uniform and just a more serious type of service to my country. I knew I wasn't going to be a man, but I knew that once I graduated from boot camp, I was going to be a Marine, and that was enough for me. I do remember worrying about what hand history was going to deal me, or fate. I wondered, am I going to be in the service during a time of peace, where maybe I'll be at Camp Lejeune or Camp Pendleton and I'll be bored to tears for 4 years? Or will it be a war and I'll be excited and I'll be a hero and I'll be a man forever respected? You know, I'll be like my dad. I'll be like all those men that were my dad's friends that I admired. Finally, I would step out of their shadow and stand beside them. I wanted that very much. And the communists were the enemy. So this enemy that I had had all of my life, that I had feared all of my life, now was a literal enemy in Southeast Asia. And my president was telling me that we needed to fight communism in Asia. And while I wasn't fighting the Russians, I was fighting their stooges. So again, it was just another step on that path that had started as far back as I can remember, from one uniform to another, but one constant enemy. an enemy to me, an enemy to my family, an enemy to my country. And I couldn't wait. When I enlisted, I wanted to be a hero. When I volunteered for the infantry and volunteered to go to Vietnam, I knew I was going to be a hero. After my first firefight with the North Vietnamese Army, all I wanted to be was a survivor. I was just an American teenager who loved the Beach Boys and the Beatles, who loved the Kansas City Athletics as I was growing up. I wasn't an athlete at all, but I had grown up with a sense of citizenship and a realization that I had lived 17 years of freedom, 17 years of protection, 17 years of the privilege of living in a free, democratic society, and being asked to serve that society in a time of war did not seem like an outrageous request to me. It just all made sense.
Tell me about when you first landed in Vietnam.
I went over on a troop ship, which was an exciting experience in and of itself. Most guys went over on airliners. But 33 days at sea on an old World War II Liberty ship. Worst living conditions I ever had until I was in the jungle. But it was thrilling to me because Marines were soldiers of the sea, and we'd always gone to war from ships. And I was going to war the way the Marines had always gone to war. So for a young kid with a sense of history, it was great. When I arrived in Vietnam, my first experience was to be assaulted by the physical and the sensual experience that was Vietnam. And that was in intense heat and smells, things I'd smelled that I'd never smelled before, and other smells I'd never smelled as great. And in concert with all of these other smells, Vietnam just had a smell that was completely foreign to me. And while I went down the nets and got into the landing craft, just like those brave young Marines had at Tarawa and Peleliu and Iwo Jima, when the gates dropped on their ships and I rushed ashore, I wasn't under fire. There were people offering me Cokes and books of an explicit sexual nature that you certainly didn't see in Independence, Missouri. I climbed on a truck that had my unit's number on it and started driving down these roads and through villages. I mean, thatched, hooched villages. People literally relieving themselves by the side of the road of both sexes. People with their teeth were black, and it looked like they were spitting blood. And it's betel nut, which is a mild narcotic that they chew, and it turns the teeth black. And the saliva that's generated is blood red. So all of these things are assaulting, you know, a kid from middle America. And I just thought, I might as well have been on the moon. You know, it was so foreign to me. And I remember literally thinking, my God, this place is full of foreigners. And it didn't dawn on me for a little bit that, yeah, it was full of foreigners, and I was one of them. And I was a replacement. That means I didn't go over with my unit. I didn't arrive with my unit and have my buddies all around me. The guys I went over with, I'd been training with since I enlisted, and they were as close to me as my own family. But then we got separated, and we went to fill the vacancies in other units. And I was told that I was filling the vacancy of a Marine who'd been killed. And I was not only judged against what he had been, I was considered a threat because I was an unknown. And I was unblooded. It's a very lonely feeling. because these kids that I was joining were dealing with the ultimate in realities, life and death. And your future literally depended on the man that was standing next to you. And they didn't know me. And it was one of the loneliest feelings I ever had in my life.
How long was it before you faced your first battle?
It was my third night in country. We took fire on my first night patrol. And it was not a big deal in retrospect. But at the time that it happened to me, it was the biggest thing in my life. Incoming tracers look a whole lot different than outgoing tracers. And I discovered what it was like to be under fire. It wasn't like the movies. And I did not do well. I was so scared that all of my dreams of glory and all my dreams of how I was going to react under fire evaporated when I was flooded with fear. I suddenly became a kid, a little kid that wanted to go home real bad.
So tell me about your experience from there on.
When I arrived, I was in the 1st Marine Division, and I'd been assigned to a military police battalion, which was a stunner to me because I was an infantry rifleman. And I didn't want to be an MP. And it turned out that the unit that I was in wasn't... We were a part of a military police battalion, but our company was really just a reinforced rifle platoon. And we were the combat reaction force for what was an area called the Da Nang East Compound. And we ran day and night patrols. It was straight infantry work. Day and night patrols and ambushes and roadblocks, security for high-value targets. And if anyone made contact anywhere in our AO, our area of operations, and required assistance, we were the fire brigade, the reaction force. We would react to their contact and go out and assist them. I didn't like the job, because it wasn't the role that I had imagined myself fulfilling. While I was doing infantry work, I was operating in an AO that was heavily populated, and we were operating under tremendous number of restrictions that were detrimental to our safety. Don't fire unless fired upon. A lot of restrictions on how to deal with the civilian population. It was not the role I pictured myself filling. I wanted to be in the varsity, and this was not the varsity to me. By then, the Marine Corps had started moving north. I'd been in Da Nang, the Da Nang area, but the 3rd Marine Division had gone up north to the demilitarized zone, that sector between North and South Vietnam, and were fighting the North Vietnamese Army, not the Viet Cong. That's where I wanted to be. And I was given the opportunity to volunteer to go up there, and I did. Once again, having no real concept. I'd been under fire a few times, so I thought I know what this is all about. But in the 3rd Marine Division, we were fighting an enemy that was conventional, in division strength, not just handfuls of people here and there. We were fighting a conventional enemy who maneuvered in regimental and division strength. That's a whole lot of people. They wouldn't hit us unless they outnumbered us. And we discovered that our role was we were bait. They would send us out in small patrols, squad-sized, platoon-sized, or even company-sized patrols in areas where the enemy was known to be, encouraging the enemy to attack us. So when the enemy attacked us, we could then call in all of our muscle, That was heavy artillery and air, especially air. The one thing that we had that the enemy didn't was jets. And we called it God, calling in God to bring hell from the heavens, right? It saved our lives countless times. So I grew up fishing, and when we would fish and using minnows for bait, we would stick the hook under the minnow's spine so we could swim to invite the big fish to attack it. It didn't take long for us to realize that we were the minnow. And we knew even when you caught the big fish, the minnow got consumed. Now, the enemy also realized what we were doing. And they had a strategy and a tactic to counter our strength. Their strategy was exhibited by a phrase called, "When you fight the Americans, hang on to their belts." That meant they wouldn't initiate contact with us until, one, they vastly outnumbered us, and two, they wouldn't initiate contact until we were very close. And they would immediately try to penetrate our, what you call, unit integrity, try to get in amongst us, so that if we wanted to call in air and artillery, we had to call it in on ourselves. And it came down to that. So they countered our strength of heavy artillery and air by getting amongst us in fights and making it difficult for us to call in God. That increased the horror factor of a firefight tremendously. The best way I can describe it is they were intimate. We didn't call those firefights, we called them brawls. And they were, the enemy was, all of them had automatic weapons. And our government had forced a rifle on us that didn't work. There are thousands of names engraved in a black wall in Washington, D.C., who died because the rifle their government gave them to protect themselves and serve their country could not be depended upon. American fighting men, children, who would be executed because their rifles were jammed and they couldn't fight. If I sound bitter about that, it's because I am. I will never forgive this country for doing that to us. There was no excuse for it. While the enemy was carrying the most dependable assault rifle on the face of this earth, the AK-47, which is still in the hands of our enemies today and still working. But we couldn't count on it. And that was just one of a number of things that convinced me very early on that no matter what we did as the young warriors, our country was determined to lose that war because we couldn't fight it the way they were making us fight it and win it. War's a real estate business. You take property from your enemy. You deny them the strategic access, whatever the benefits are of that property to them militarily, you're denying that to them. The natural resources, you're denying that to them. The human resources, you're denying that to them. In Vietnam, we would fight for something, and then when the enemy would leave, or we'd kill them all, we'd leave. They'd come back, we'd go back. We were constantly reacting to them. And it was disconcerting for me to be wounded in places that I knew that maybe I'd already fought in, or I knew other Americans had fought in. And that's no way to win a war. That's a remedy for failure, not success. So as a young infantryman, just looking at the profession, I was disappointed and discouraged, knowing that what we were going through, I couldn't see any way that any of our suffering would have any positive result for our country, for the South Vietnamese that we were supposedly defending. And I was there, luckily for me, I was there when we were still bombing the hell out of North Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. And we knew that it was possible, theoretically possible, strategically absolutely necessary, that one day they're going to give us the order to cross the DMZ and invade North Vietnam and take that real estate away from the communist. While I was in the hospital, right after I got out of the hospital, President Nixon came on TV and announced that we were going to begin a withdrawal. Every American that went to Vietnam or was in Vietnam after he made that speech knew that they were fighting for a defeat, that no matter what they were going to be asked to sacrifice, this country had already notified the enemy that this is not worth winning to us, and we're going to leave. But in the meantime, all those brave kids, all of Americans' children, all the poor and working class kids that nobody valued except their families, who were in Vietnam, knew that if they died, it wasn't going to be for anything except their buddies. And I reached the inescapable conclusion, as a Vietnam veteran and as an American citizen, that then I had to do something to bring that war to a close, at least for my country.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, I joined Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and I worked actively to end the war in which I'd fought. And that was the most difficult decision I ever made in my life. I knew I was going to disappoint some people that loved me very much, that were going to find it difficult to understand. I knew that there would be people that I had admired that might consider me a traitor. I knew there were Marines that I loved that might think I was stabbing them in the back. I knew that my president was going to treat me like I was a criminal. I didn't want to go through any of that. But the way I felt when I enlisted was this was something a whole lot bigger than me. And it was my duty. That's why I enlisted. Well, now I was facing that war again, realizing that this is a whole lot bigger than me. And this now is my duty. And so I became outspoken.
John, you were only in your 20s at the time.
Yes. I was out of the Marine Corps before I was old enough to vote or considered responsible enough to drink a beer. I can remember being told, after you've been in combat, it'll make a man out of you. You grow up in combat. But I didn't find that to be true. What I found to be true is that you grow old. I remember guys saying, for example, and I said it, and this is the way I would say it, well, I was born in Missouri, but I grew up in Vietnam. When we were teenagers, we were dealing with what most people don't deal with until they're in their late 60s and 70s, and that's the deaths of friends and facing your own death. And that's just theoretically. You don't confront those things until you're older, because we live in, thank God, a very safe society. But those of us who were in the bush, we were dealing with that as a horrific reality. Death became a constant for us, a reality, a real flesh and blood, literally, reality. We lived by breaths, not by days, not by hours. It takes a second to be disabled. It takes a second to be killed. And we lived by seconds. And when you think of how many seconds there are in 13 months, because the Marine Corps, everybody else served 12 months. Well, by God, that's not good enough for the Marine Corps. We're going to serve an extra month. We'll show those other guys. You know how many seconds are in that extra month? How many brave young Marines died when they should have been home, like their brothers in the Air Force and the Navy and the Army and the Coast Guard? I love the Marine Corps. I did then, I still do. I owe the Marine Corps more than I could ever hope to repay. But that wasn't right. Just to show up the other branches to make us look tougher. It was wrong. But that's the way it was. So, chronologically, I was in my early 20s, 22 maybe, when I joined VVAW. I felt like an old man.
If you're just joining us, today on KPR presents The Vietnam Journey of John Musgrave. Veteran, poet, and Baldwin resident John Musgrave is featured prominently in the new public television documentary, The Vietnam War, by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Eagles Rest, a locally owned furniture store in Lawrence and Kansas City, specializing in toxin-free customizable mattresses by Savvy Rest. All natural latex, wool, and cotton with a 20-year warranty. Online at EaglesRestNaturalHome.com.
How old were you when you were wounded?
When I was wounded the first and second time, I was 19. The first time was shrapnel from a hand grenade. It wasn't a serious wound. I stayed in the field with my unit. The last time I was wounded, I was shot. First round was a ricochet that hit me in the chin and fractured my jaw, knocked me unconscious. When I regained consciousness, which I think was just a matter of moments, I was lying on my face, and we were in an ambush. And according to the after-action report, my platoon made contact with the North Vietnamese Army Battalion and called it a 3.5-hour fierce firefight. I was one of the first people to be shot. The man who shot me was a veteran, and he knew that my buddies would come for me, and that's when I became his bait. Another way to be bait. And when my first buddy ran up to me and bent over and stuck his hands under my arms and cupped my shoulders and pulled me up, the machine gunner, who was only a matter of feet away from me, fired another burst into my chest. And they killed him. Those bullets that hit me were traveling over 2,300 feet per second. So the bullets actually hit me before I heard the sound of the gun going off. And he was only 8-10 feet away at the most. It was intimate. And the next guy that came for me was shot. Marines never leave their wounded, never. We would die before we would leave our wounded. My mind couldn't even keep up with my body. The impact of the bullets was so powerful that I thought it split me between my shoulders, and I thought my shoulders slammed together in front of my face. It's impossible, but that's what I thought happened. And it was the worst pain that I'd ever felt in my life, and I was trying to make sense of it, and I heard this horrible, inhuman screaming. And I was trying to figure out who was screaming like that. And then I realized it was me. And then my body, my mind and my body caught up with one another. And the thought in my mind was, I've been shot in the chest, I'm going to die, shut up. Because it was making it harder on my buddies. And then began a fight to rescue me and the other wounded. There were 19 wounded and one killed. For over 49 years, I thought I caused the deaths of two Marines, but I just found out it was only one. Although when you've been carrying that kind of guilt for over 49 years, it's knowing something intellectually is, it's different than being able to convince yourself, because that guilt's as much a part of me as my scars and my disability. But my buddies grabbed me and the other wounded, and they, while being pursued by the North Vietnamese, they would drag us for a little ways and then drop us and lay down on top of me and fire back at the enemy. They knew I was dying. I had a fist-sized hole through my chest and out my back. And I told them to leave me. I gave them permission to leave me. I begged them to leave me. I didn't want anybody else to die because of me. And I knew that it was a done deal. But they wouldn't do it. And then at one point, I became afraid they would. And one of the guys that was carrying me, I was dragging me. I had one guy on each arm dragging me. Both my sons are named after them, by the way. I pulled him down, because with my left lung gun, all I could do was whisper with gasp. And I said, don't let them get me alive. And in the midst of all this, his nose is just about touching mine. He's looking me in the eye, and he says, don't worry. They won't get you alive. And I knew he would kill me, rather than let the North Vietnamese do what they did to us when they caught us wounded. And I owed him as much for that as I did for him carrying me out, for the sense of relief that washed over me. Then I could get back to praying for my family and my buddies. You don't see that in the war movies, but that's the way it was for me. I was triaged three times. That's where they determine whether or not they can work on you or you're not worth the effort. Three times I was considered expectant. Senior corpsman, when they got us back to the company, said I can't do anything for him. And the XO of the company, who had been my former platoon commander, held me in his arms. A helicopter came in under fire and had already been told that they didn't have to come in because it was a hot LZ, which meant we were under fire. And I was told later that the pilot said, those are Marines down there, I'm going to come in and get them. They threw me on the bird, and then corpsman on the bird straddled me, looked down at me, saw the size of the hole in my chest, and looked at the crew chief, and just like he was declaring me out, gave the thumb, you know, like an umpire clearing you out at home plate. And they shoved me over under the feet of the portside gunner. And I thought, well, okay. And that gunner held my hand from the DMZ to the, just south of the DMZ to Dong Ha. And every time I started to fade, and if I would have gone unconscious, I'd have died. He would squeeze my hand real hard, and it was like pulling me out of the quicksand each time. Another man saving my life. They had to pry my hand loose from that gunner, because I was afraid if I let go of him, then I wouldn't be able to pull out again. Got to Delta Med at Dong Ha, and the surgeon came over and looked at me, and they're bringing in helicopter loads of damaged teenagers. And the room was filled with screams. And I got my hopes up, but they got me in there, and I thought, okay, maybe I got a chance. And I'm lucid, I'm talking. And he said, there's nothing I can do for this man. And he looked at me and he says, what's your religion, Marine? And I told him, he says, get a chaplain over here. And he left. So I went, oh, okay. Chaplain came over and was standing behind me and was praying. And I'm okay with it. I mean, I knew. I'd already talked to God about it. And another Marine, as you were, another Navy surgeon was walking by my rack, and he glanced at me, and I smiled and nodded at him. And he said, why isn't somebody helping this man? And in my mind, I said, yeah, why isn't somebody helping this man? And they started working on me. There wasn't much they could do. They started blood. That was good because I was just about tapped out. One of my best friends was lying on the sawhorses next to me. He'd been shot in the right side of the chest. A C-130 aircraft is a four-engine heavy aircraft that the military uses to transport supplies and troops. It's a big airplane. They put two Marines who were both expectant on a C-130 at Dong Ha and flew us to Alpha Med at Phu Bai, where they had thoracic surgeons waiting for us. Because there were so many casualties at Dong Ha, they literally could not waste the time on us who they expected to die when they knew there were men that could be saved. It made perfect sense, and I wasn't arguing with that. But they did that. This whole big airplane for two enlisted Marines and a corpsman for each of us that was changing the blood bags out, because as quick as it'd go in, it'd go right back out. But that was their job. And they got us to Alpha Med, and there were surgeons waiting there for us. And then I knew they would put me to sleep, and I knew, well, I can't fight to live anymore. And I just delivered my spirit into God's hands then, and was amazed when I woke up in the intensive care ward. My parents, I think, got a telegram every day or every other day giving prognosis and update, because I was touch and go for a while. But that was a train or a trail, almost like the stages of the cross, of people that were essential to saving my life throughout that day, from my buddies to that brave helicopter crew to that door gunner that held my hand to the surgeon that stopped at Dong Ha, to the surgeon that was waiting for me at Phu Bai. I don't know anybody in this world that's luckier than I am, you know. But after I was separated from the Marine Corps and I was treated like I was a war criminal by my contemporaries, the men that I admired and wanted to emulate, calling us losers because we weren't winning our war, wasn't our fault. With all my demons, depression, in this case called post-traumatic stress, is insidious. It changes the meaning of words or concepts. I became so consumed with what's called survivor guilt. Why am I alive when my buddies are dead? Because they were better men than I was by far. It changes the way you look at things, it twists things up. And instead of looking at my survival as this wonderful gift, it was, men sacrificed their lives to purchase my future. But I became so confused and wrapped up in the pain that I looked at it as a burden rather than this priceless gift. And I began where I, every night, I was wondering if this would be the night I'd have the courage to complete the sentence that had been passed on me that day in that ambush. I was supposed to die then. And all I could feel was the psychic pain and the emotional pain and the physical pain that suicide suddenly looked like a positive act rather than the ultimate negative act. And you become convinced that the people you love would be better served by your death than by your survival. And Vietnam veterans, we didn't have the VA system to help us then because they didn't recognize post-traumatic stress. We didn't have a sympathetic populace to support us, to care. We were literally on our own. And more Vietnam veterans have died by suicide since the war ended than were killed in action. I personally think that's an indictment of this society, because they needed help and there was no help to be given. It wasn't that they weren't seeking it. It was that it was not there. It was non-existent. The deadliest battle I ever fought in my life wasn't in the jungles of Vietnam. It was in my bedroom every night for years after I came home, until my first child was handed to me. And then never again, never thought of it again. I didn't have a future, but they did. And their future was more important to me than anything on this earth. And they needed me, and I needed them. I kept myself alive before that, because I was in my mid-30s before I had kids, by riding my motorcycle real fast. I jumped out airplanes for 20 years because every time I cleared the door of the airplane, I wanted to live forever just so I could keep doing that. Because when I cleared the door, I was cleansed. I'd never been in a war. I'd never been hurt. I'd never hurt anybody else. I'd never killed anybody. I'd never been betrayed. I was at perfect peace in free fall. A lot of people thought, oh, he's got a death wish. No. It was just the opposite. As long as I could do it, it kept me alive. It was a refuge.
To what extent did writing also help?
That helped keep me alive in the darkest times. I did the majority of my writing in those long nights. I discovered that I had to get these things out of me. When I talked to students about writing those poems, I tell them it was like lancing a boil or sticking my finger down my throat. I had to purge poisons that were in my system. I had to get them out of my system. And I discovered that if I could get them on paper, I could literally, and it may sound strange, but I could literally physically push them away from me. Of course, it's symbolic, but for me, it turned out to be very important symbolism. And if I could get it out on paper, I could step back and deal with it. And also, of course, every poet craves immortality, and the hope that maybe someday somebody might read them and would learn something from them, would be moved by them. But primarily, each one of them was like taking a step in a positive direction, instead of being consumed by those demons, I was, with each poem, I was expelling them. And it was just a little piece at a time. I would tell myself every night when I was looking at my pistol or holding it, if I really want to do this, I can do it tomorrow. And I've worked with vets from Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's one of the things I tell them. I say, just put it off. I'm not asking you to make the decision of your life, and all of a sudden you're going to think about what I say to you and have an epiphany, and everything's ever going to be okay. That's not realistic. Just put it off. Just put it off for a day. Every day, just put it off for one more day. And let those days work themselves into months, and those months into years, until you can stand on your own and put those where they belong. Put those thoughts where they belong. Try to turn them to your benefit rather than to your peril. I literally had to make a decision on whether the war was going to be one of the most negative experiences of my life or one of the most positive. I realized that I had to put it in its place. And I got two legal pads, and I sat down and I said, okay, I'm going to start out with the negatives. And I started writing, and I kept turning the page, and all these things that made it a horrible experience. And I finally reached a point, and I said, God, I need to start on the positive pad. And I shifted over to the other pad, and I wrote down my buddies. And then I got it. And I put the pen down, and I was done. Those guys that I served with, who were considered by the government of the United States as expendable, that if America lost 60,000 of those kids, it would not be much to ask. That's why they protected the middle class and the upper class with their college deferments. I learned more about what it meant to be an American from then than I ever learned at home, and I learned more about the true definition of love from them than I ever learned at home. And I came from a very loving, supportive, extended family. But this was more than that. And I realized what an inspiration to me they had been and continue to be to this day. And I cannot imagine who I would be had I not have known them. I know I would have been the less, I know that. And in knowing that, I would not have known them any other way but to have been in that war with them. Then I realized that that made it one of the most positive experiences of my life. And I no longer needed to feel victimized by that experience. That because of them, I feel empowered and grateful. And to feel any less than that would be to diminish them. And no one has that right. Certainly not me. I owe them my life. And so I will forever be grateful that God put them in my life. And it has helped me in dealing with my experience. Always keeping that realization to the forefront. Everything that I went through was worth it to have been beside them. And that's just the way it is.
John, you're featured quite prominently in Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's documentary, Vietnam. What was it like to watch that?
It's pretty amazing, because I thought my role originally was to find veterans for them. because I know a number of veterans just in this community alone whose stories haven't been told and need to be. America needs to know these men and hear their stories. So I was amazed when they invited my wife and I to New York to be filmed. And then I thought, well, I'll be lucky if I get a couple of minutes. You know, maybe they'll take a sentence I've said and it'll be worthy of this. And I thought, gosh, what an honor it will be to be, even have a small part in a Ken Burns Lynn Novick film. To see the part that I've played in it has been humbling. I just hope that people will realize that, I mean, I would like to paint myself as a hero. I would love to do that. But it wouldn't be true. What I was a terrified teenager. And I think that the truth is more important than my fantasies, right? And I hope people understand that that guy that's talking in that documentary is 63 years old. That was 6 years ago. I hope that I have portrayed myself as honestly as I can so that people see that kid and not the old man. You know, does that make sense to you? But I am just honored to have had a part in it. And they are some of the most amazing people I've ever known in my life. And the service they are providing to their country is absolutely priceless.
Baldwin City resident John Musgrave was featured in the PBS documentary, The Vietnam War, directed by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.